Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
What do you get when you bring together some of the top political writers in Chicago to talk about the race for the White House? You get a very good discussion, and this weekend, we'll share some of it with you. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. The season when WBBM's Election Central is in full effect, and this past week we invited five of Chicago's best political writers and reporters to join us at our studios to dissect the presidential race. So much has changed in a relatively short amount of time. The discussion was recorded, videotaped even, on our Odyssey Radio performance stage, and you can see snippets of it on our social media and all of it on WBBMNewsRadio.com. But we'll give you a healthy selection of excerpts this weekend, starting with my introduction. Shia Kapos is a national politics reporter for Politico. I'm doing this in alphabetical order. She writes the Illinois Playbook column. Quinn Myers is a reporter for Block Club Chicago. He covers City Hall and several neighborhoods. Alex Nitkin is the government finance and accountability reporter for the Illinois Answers Project, and that is published by the Better Government Association. Gregory Pratt is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who also covers City Hall, and he wrote the book on Mayor Lori Lightfoot's term in office, literally. And Laura Washington is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a regular political analyst for ABC7 Chicago. And I thank all of you for joining us for this discussion. Let's start with really the thing I think that people are thinking about right now, and that is momentum. If we'd held this roundtable discussion on the state of the presidential race a month ago, it would be a completely different discussion than we're having now. On Sunday, July 21st, Democratic President Joe Biden decided to end his bid for re-election and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris for president in his place. That has certainly shifted the focus of the race, but I guess the first question, and I'm not going to always throw questions to a particular person, but in this case, I'm going to just start with Laura Washington. To what degree has this really shifted the momentum?
I think it's completely shifted it. It's shifted completely from Donald Trump to Kamala Harris. And the reason why is because Kamala Harris is the latest person in the race. She's the newly minted nominee. And I think there, I believe there, that a lot of the large part of this momentum was the pent-up first despair that Democrats had looking at Joe Biden as the possible or likely nominee that shifted when she got into the race, because I think people had already given up the ghost for the Democratic Party to win the White House, much less Congress, in November. When Biden got out, she was a new face, a fresh face, but people knew who she was. She was the vice president. Biden anointed her, and that turned the whole thing around.
But Quinn, I mean, is this kind of excitement sustainable?
Well, we'll see. I haven't seen a better 3 weeks in the campaign, maybe ever. The positive media coverage has been wall to wall. Meanwhile, Trump has had a couple, some would say, stumbles, including some comments made here in Chicago about Kamala Harris. He doesn't seem to be totally sure how to attack her. So I do think it's been an incredible month for the Democratic Party, but I do think reality will set in, especially as we start seeing Kamala Harris hopefully give more media interviews. She has not given any interviews since becoming Democratic frontrunner here.
Plus, Greg Pratt.
Well, one of the interesting comments that former Republican challenger to Trump, Nikki Haley, made was that the first party to drop their near octogenarian from the ticket was going to be the party that wins. And I think that that is an energy that you sort of see. Obviously, the election isn't over. There's a lot that can happen. But I think it's a really astute comment about where the dynamics are, where the country was unsatisfied with these two people. Now they've got something new to look at.
Yeah, Shia?
Well, and you look at the age was such a big issue when it was Biden versus Trump. And suddenly you look at Trump and Harris and you think, oh, wow, he's the older guy. Like, you didn't really notice it before. And suddenly age is taken a different shift, I think. And that goes to what Nikki Haley said. I think and to what Laura said, too, you know, Democrats were just excited to root for somebody, and they finally have somebody new to root for.
Yeah, but Alex, when those of us who were in Milwaukee saw a kind of excitement, and admittedly, the Republican convention happened right after the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, but the excitement level there was high, almost a fervor level. Do we discount that?
I think that they are probably feeling very different now than they did back then. Like you said, it was a completely different world. It was an 180-degree sort of difference. They were feeling this air of inevitability, like Trump was going to be president and they just needed to know by how much. And there was this sense of dread on the other side of it, of there were these, you know, festering questions of, is President Biden actually going to be able to stay in the race? And I remember, actually, there were advocates for him dropping out at the time. One I keep thinking about, of James Carville, the great, you know, Democratic strategist, commentator, saying, like, we're going to be sitting Shiva in Chicago for 4 days. It's going to be brutal. It's going to be a dirge, which, of course, is a reason why Republicans were so, you know, excited in the first place. But now it really seems like there is so much energy on the Democratic side. And if anything, you know, it makes me a little concerned that there will not be very much incentive for the Harris campaign to give interviews or to come out with policy, because they're seeing this, if you want to call it that, momentum, their polling position get better. It's sort of like, why should we change anything? Why should we get in the way of that?
Oh, I think they're going to have to do policy. They're going to have
eventually,
to do interviews,
yeah.
First of all, because the Trump campaign is going to really hit them hard and keep hitting them till they do it. Secondly, if you know, this is not going to be about the base. You want the base to be energized. Harris wants her people to get out, but you're going to have to worry about those swing voters. And they want to see some substance. They want to see some issues. They're uncertain, and it's not just about Biden being too old. It's about them being uncertain about whether this is the candidate, this is the party that they want to go with. So they're going to have to lay it out and put some really strong policies on the table. The thing that fascinated me about that whole dynamic when it changed over was that the Trump campaign was so unprepared for it. Now, you know, we didn't know what Biden was going to do, but the pressure had been building all the way up to the day he dropped out. And it became clearer and clearer that he wasn't going to be able to stay in. And in the meantime, I think the Trump people, including Donald Trump, who to this day is still saying, well, what about Biden? Whatever happened to Biden? He can't get over the fact that Biden's not in the race. So they were completely unprepared. They had no strategy. They had no talking points. They weren't able to pivot. And as it was said earlier, they still haven't pivoted. They're still scrambling around trying to find issues and talking points and strategies that are going to work against Kamala Harris.
And understand how to compete against a woman, black candidate. I think he hasn't figured out how to talk about her, how to talk to her. That debate in September is going to be really interesting.
Are you suggesting that it's a bad idea for Trump to campaign on a platform of the black lady is not a black lady?
Yeah.
It's not working for him so far.
I do think, you know, this is still truly a toss-up race, and I think there is all this excitement, especially in liberal circles, especially from all the media coverage, but Trump could very well still be elected. So I think, you know, we'll see after maybe the things will die down after the convention next week, although maybe they won't. Maybe the Kamala wave will continue.
Yeah. I mean, I think underestimating Donald Trump is how he got into office in 2016. There are still people who are, in their minds, afraid of what would happen if Democratic rule continued in Washington. You could feel that in Milwaukee with the Republicans. They had a palpable fear that that their lifestyle would not be what they want it to be.
You could say the same for the other side as well.
Right. I mean,
Biden's big point was we could see the end of democracy if Trump is reelected. But the other interesting dynamic is that it seems like it's sort of flipped in terms of where the fear factor is. You know, Trump was the scary guy who was going to end democracy, who was a criminal, all this kind of stuff. Now, up against Kamala Harris, you're seeing more of a weaker Trump. He's not looking as big and scary as he did when he was up against Joe Biden. And I think that partly that's because Kamala Harris has so much momentum and because she's changed her messaging. She's not talking about the end of democracy, the world's going to end. She's talking about this guy's weird, this campaign is
weird.
It's
a little bit more nuanced, right, to make it relatable to regular people who don't understand what doom and gloom. Does it really matter who the president is? But if you're talking about weird, you know, that's a word we sort of get.
Well, both political parties have things that they can talk about that affect normal people and they speak to people's concerns about it. And one of the interesting things about Trump that has been really would concern me if I was his strategist is they gave him a 3,000-word speech for the RNC. He delivered a 12,000-word speech. He should be running the Joe Biden 2020 campaign of say a few things, speak to some issues, don't do anything crazy and stay in your basement. And he'd be in better off than coming out and reminding people about some of the chaos and uncertainty, like the comments about Kamala Harris, which don't really do anything for anyone. I don't know who that is, who he's speaking to other than his own id.
Well, his visit to Chicago is a perfect example of that, too. He must have known he would get questions about how he has spoken and treated black people. So he should have been prepared. I thought the question did come out really strong initially.
And you're talking about the NABJ?
The NABJ conference. And he could have finessed it a little bit at the beginning. Instead, he dug right back in.
And I'm going to want to move on to something else, but I sincerely believe he gave exactly the answer that he wanted to give. I think he wanted to push back hard, at least on that, and not answer the question that he was asked. Which
he was speaking to his base.
Yes.
He wasn't speaking to the black journalists in the room.
Right.
That's true.
But let's start talking about some of the issues in the race, because if there was any complaint, I think that I personally had after the debate between the former president and the current president, it was that if you had only seen the news coverage of that event, you would have no idea what either man had said about any issue, because the only coverage was Biden not being able to handle things. You wouldn't even know what Trump said about any issue. So let's start talking about some of the issues, and the big one for Republicans and Democrats in different directions: immigration. I mean, Donald Trump and Republicans attack Kamala Harris as the designated border czar, and the GOP attacks running mate Tim Walz for last year signing legislation that open state services and benefits to undocumented immigrants. And they call those examples of the Harris-Walz campaign radical left. Is that a good path for them?
I think on a base level, yes. I think it's important to note that Kamala Harris was never an official border czar. She wasn't charged with looking at the root causes of migration in South and Central American countries, but it could be an effective talking point. I do think President Biden's decision to strictly limit asylum seeking in June, I can't believe it was only 2 months ago, did have a big impact. In Chicago, we haven't seen a bus of migrants arrive here in, I believe, almost 2 months.
Right.
So I do think that kind of shifted the narrative. Whereas before, Trump was making pretty easy comments about open borders and how they're just coming to cities, et cetera. But I do think that that will remain an effective tactic for Trump. Whether Harris can counter that, it kind of remains to be seen. We haven't seen any specifics on what she would do immigration-wise in her policy platform.
Their Democrats seem to be saying, look, we had a bipartisan deal, and Trump waded into it and scared Republicans off of it, so the deal never happened, and that immigration could have been solved a little bit earlier before Biden got involved, but Trump got involved. So that'll be the talking point, I think, of Democrats.
Yeah. Alex?
What's interesting is that it seems like Democrats have really seized upon that. And if anything, Kamala Harris, one of her first, if not only, issue-based ads that has come out has been on that specific topic and saying Kamala Harris is going to secure our border. And it's interesting. It's a reflection of your seeing just this very different sort of political climate than existed even 4 years ago, where it seems like the country, and even by extension sort of the center of the Democratic Party, is more immigration skeptical, immigration hostile, whatever you want to call it. But it seems like the more mainstream sort of take that the Harris campaign is running toward is one of, you know, strong borders and limiting immigration, and they're really trying to own that topic, including with that, the fallout from that failed bill, and now with this ad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are still seeing, at least in big cities like Chicago, immigrants on the streets. If you're in the downtown area, you'll see every street corner as somebody selling candy. And there is that fear, at least in some of the disinvested neighborhoods, that somehow the resources that might have gone to those neighborhoods are now going to migrants. And so that's I think that that's a vulnerability for the Democrats.
Well, one of the few, you know, when Trump came to NABJ, he had one specific strategy in mind, which is pit black people against migrants. You know, he was a talking point he kept turning back to, which is a real dynamic that you see in the city of Chicago and in other places where you have people who have been here for a while and disinvested areas and poor areas who have some resentments about some of this. And he's been trying to stoke that, except it's pretty transparent, you know, and so it hasn't necessarily been received as well. But that's something that he's stoking, and Harris is trying to counter it by saying he blew up the deal that would fix this problem, but we're closing down the border anyway. And she's a border state senator. She was a border state senator in California. She is much better equipped to talk about that than Joe Biden was.
I think that stoking those fears, though, is not just African-American versus Latino or the immigrants from South and Latin America and African-Americans. It's also immigrant families or immigrant, historically immigrant families who here in Chicago who have resentments about, you know, we're not that much better off than the migrants that they're accepting. So I think that tension was there long before these Greg Abbott and company started sending these folks here. But I think that in terms of policy, I think long term, she's also going to have to be able to address not only closing the border, but what do we do with the folks that are already here who aren't here legally, who technically can't get work, who are sitting on the street selling candies. We're going to have to find a way to adjust the policy and laws to address that. Because I think there's a really compelling argument to make, and maybe this should be part of our argument, that these people are valuable to us. We need good workers. We need people who can work in the restaurants, work in the stores, and fill these jobs and contribute to the tax base. But in order to do that, we have to get them legalized and get them into the system.
And at the Republican convention, you had Donald Trump, what the placards were saying, mass deportation. I mean, that there are stories out about how mass deportation, deporting people, would cause inflation in a whole different way. It would hurt the economy in a whole different way.
Yeah, and that's never a winner because it's such a everybody knows somebody who immigrated here, who they like, who they respect, who they appreciate. And so even people that have issues with the border, concerns about this, don't like the sound of mass deportation. We're going to get rid of millions and millions of people because it sounds ominous.
What are you going to do, knock on doors? I mean, it sounds terrible.
But certain negative Trump surrogates have talked explicitly about doing that very thing. Whether logistically that could even be possible is another question.
Yeah.
But I do think that kind of the larger, you know, there's been so much media coverage on the migrant crisis, the so-called migrant crisis. We haven't talked a lot about the Dreamers, people who have been here and seeking a life here for, their whole lives, potentially, if they came here with their parents. You know, I think Donald Trump has not made any promises about protections for that population, whereas Democrats, in theory, have. So it will be interesting to see if any of that plays out in this election, especially as more and more Latino people seem to be kind of voting for Trump or supporting him.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. This weekend, you're hearing a portion of the political analysis we performed on the presidential race with Laura Washington of the Chicago Tribune and ABC 7 Chicago, Gregory Pratt with the Tribune, Alex Nitkin with the Better Government Association's Illinois Answers Project, Quinn Myers with Block Club Chicago, and Shia Kapos with Politico. Back to our discussion.
Let's turn to another headline issue that people care about. Crime. The Trump campaign accuses former California Attorney General Kamala Harris of releasing dangerous criminals back onto the streets and being in favor of sanctuary cities and defunding the police. But Trump himself has courted the African American vote by promoting second chance efforts for those who have been incarcerated. Again, the messages seem to be coming from different directions, but is anybody delivering a coherent message except that one side wants to protect ownership of guns and the other side wants to severely limit it?
Well, I don't think it's quite that stark, though, because of Tim Walz, the vice presidential nominee to be, or already nominee, is, you know, he's a hunter, he's a gun owner, he's very prominent and proud of that. He's proud of the fact that he once had his NRA rating has changed over time because of that. And I think that helps leaven the Democrats and Harris's position on guns. The argument I think they're going to make is that, you know, we want to ensure safety. We want to ensure that people are safe from illegal use of guns. We want to make sure the guns are kept out of the hands of the wrong people. And that, I think, is a compelling argument that they can make.
But there's really been no talk about, you know, curbing crime. And, you know, in the past few years, we've seen several waves of tough on crime and then kind of backing off of it. I don't think I've seen any policies that really look at, you know, cities like Chicago, big cities that are dealing with crime waves, robberies, et cetera. There's been loose talk on broad talk on gun control, but how that will actually trickle down to a city like Chicago is still pretty unclear.
Plus, crime is dropping in Chicago, which makes it a more difficult talking point, I think.
Crime, like the economy, is a highly personal thing for people, and they don't, you know, how they feel about it doesn't necessarily track with statistics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. In fact, those two issues are very much alike. People don't feel safe, and you tell them crime is dropping, but they hear the headlines. You know, how many young people in Chicago were shot and killed over the weekend? This weekend,
there's a body count every weekend,
and that
dominates the headlines, and that's all people see and hear.
But when you have a police superintendent saying, well, no one actually died on the weekend, but one person succumbed to their wounds, and you know, you're still, how many people were shot? We are not hearing the solid policies, I think. And what can they say? I mean, the gun issue seems to be where some of this has to go, but it seems like both sides are afraid to really grapple with it.
Well, you know, on crime and on guns, but specifically on crimes, they're interlinked. You know, young people really care about school shootings. They care about gun violence because they've lived an entire existence of every few months, some whack job gets a big gun and shoots a whole bunch of people for no reason, and the government doesn't do anything about it, and they get upset. And young people really feel that acutely in a way that, that other generations don't. And that's going to be a recurring issue that's a problem for Republicans and something that Kamala Harris will probably be talking about in terms of certain types of weapons being an issue. But in general, they're not talking a ton about crime. And it's interesting. They're trying to go after walls over the George Floyd protests. But, you know, we've seen locally and we've seen nationally that the defund the police argument doesn't kill candidates the way that they thought it would. You know, they made that argument against Brandon Johnson in Chicago, and he was able to win. They made that argument. They're making that argument against Tim Walz and Kamala Harris. And so I think people aren't looking for slogans. They're looking for something more substantive.
Partially because none of these people ever actually have defunded police departments. Even if it was a slogan, like, this mayor in Chicago has increased the police, you know, budget and probably will again. And so did, you know, Harris in whatever capacity and Walz.
Yeah, I mean, it seems as if people didn't really mean defund the police. What people meant was take some of the money that is maybe being spent on police and putting it in mental health. And when you frame the argument that way, I think you get more acceptance from people. Quinn?
I was just going to say, we have seen some backlash against, you know, the DAs and the top prosecutors around the country. You know, the recent state's attorney's election here was in some ways a referendum on crime here. It'll be interesting to see if that, you know, trickles upwards. Although I do think, you know, the two candidates in the Democratic primary were actually not too dissimilar. They had to draw some lines there to appeal the voters.
For
Cook County State's attorney. But you would, you know, the candidate who was very simply labeled the tough on crime candidate did win that election.
Well, the only thing I would point out to that, because you're right, but even the so-called tough on crime DA candidate in county state's attorney candidate, in her TV ad, she was talking about restorative justice, which is how far the pendulum has swung, where even the tough candidate is talking about not tough stuff.
Well, you're hearing about half of what we did and said in the studio, but let's jump ahead a bit where the discussion turned to reproductive rights.
That was a big issue the last time. It's still an issue. I'm not sure it's the same this time.
Those are the voters, those Republican, probably women voters, who might not be sure what to think about Trump, who support abortion rights, who support reproductive rights. To hear him make comments about gender the way he does that, I could see that turning those voters off. And those are the people that he wants to keep in the Republican Party. So I think it is a mistake on his part to start using the gender card, you know, because I think there are Republican women on the bubble who he could bring into the fold.
But is it smart or should Democrats make an assumption that the reproductive rights issue is all theirs, and that it is, I mean, because I've seen, if not more, but I've seen a substantial number of people who are anti-abortion on the Democratic side, too.
Yeah, but I think that it's been a winning, reproductive rights has been a winning issue for the Democrats in the last couple of election cycles. For one thing, it really energizes their base and gets people out. They want to make sure that those rights are protected. And for another thing, they've been much more expansive in terms of how they look at abortion rights. And now we have these laws that are these referenda, these policies that are popping up in states. We just saw it in Arizona where they're going to put something on the ballot that if it's passed in November would protect those rights. Those are the kinds of agenda items, those are the kinds of laws and efforts that will really bring out voters, women voters, whether they be Democrats or Republicans.
This is an issue, sorry, Greg, that was a winner for Democrats in states like Kansas and Kentucky. And so I think that, just like Laura said, Democrats very rightly realize that at this moment in this political climate, it really is, it makes policy and politics sense for them to lean in on it. And I think we're going to hear a lot about it next week.
And she'll be talking about that. You know, it's implicit in her message of we will not go back, which is part of the argument that she's trying to make. And, you know, on those levels, I'm surprised that the Harris campaign and Democrats aren't making a bigger deal out of the Supreme Court as it relates to gay marriage rights and to LGBTQ rights, which the Supreme Court has been clear they're going after. You know, Thomas and Alito have been pretty clear about we have an issue with these past rulings, and young people in particular are very against that. You know, they're very against going after that. So I think a lot of these social issues are winners for the Democrats if they go after them. And some of them they're not quite talking about, but they probably should.
You're seeing Walls talk a lot about it, you know, using kind of, you know, down-home language, like, get them out of our, you know, they
should
be,
mind your own damn business.
Yeah, mind your own damn business. So that goes to those issues, I think.
My thanks to my colleagues and friends, Shia Kapos, Quinn Myers, Alex Nitkin, Greg Pratt, and Laura Washington, for a great afternoon of talk and analysis. The Democratic National Convention is this week here in Chicago. Lots to look and listen for. Now, to our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website. That's WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
What do you get when you bring together some of the top political writers in Chicago to talk about the race for the White House? You get a very good discussion, and this weekend, we'll share some of it with you. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. The season when WBBM's Election Central is in full effect, and this past week we invited five of Chicago's best political writers and reporters to join us at our studios to dissect the presidential race. So much has changed in a relatively short amount of time. The discussion was recorded, videotaped even, on our Odyssey Radio performance stage, and you can see snippets of it on our social media and all of it on WBBMNewsRadio.com. But we'll give you a healthy selection of excerpts this weekend, starting with my introduction.
Shia Kapos is a national politics reporter for Politico. I'm doing this in alphabetical order. She writes the Illinois Playbook column. Quinn Myers is a reporter for Block Club Chicago. He covers City Hall and several neighborhoods. Alex Nitkin is the government finance and accountability reporter for the Illinois Answers Project, and that is published by the Better Government Association. Gregory Pratt is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who also covers City Hall, and he wrote the book on Mayor Lori Lightfoot's term in office, literally. And Laura Washington is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a regular political analyst for ABC7 Chicago. And I thank all of you for joining us for this discussion. Let's start with really the thing I think that people are thinking about right now, and that is momentum. If we'd held this roundtable discussion on the state of the presidential race a month ago, it would be a completely different discussion than we're having now. On Sunday, July 21st, Democratic President Joe Biden decided to end his bid for re-election and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris for president in his place. That has certainly shifted the focus of the race. But I guess the first question, and I'm not going to always throw questions to a particular person, but in this case, I'm going to just start with Laura Washington. To what degree has this really shifted the momentum?
I think it's completely shifted it. It's shifted completely from Donald Trump to Kamala Harris. And the reason why is because Kamala Harris is the latest person in the race. She's the newly minted nominee. And I think that a lot of the large part of this momentum was the pent-up first despair that Democrats had looking at Joe Biden as the possible or likely nominee. That shifted when she got into the race, because I think people had already given up the ghost for the Democratic Party to win the White House, much less Congress, in November. When Biden got out, she was a new face, a fresh face, but people knew who she was. She was the vice president. Biden anointed her, and that turned the whole thing around.
But Quinn, is this kind of excitement sustainable?
Well, we'll see. I haven't seen a better 3 weeks in the campaign, maybe ever. The positive media coverage has been wall to wall. Meanwhile, Trump has had a couple, some would say, stumbles, including some comments made here in Chicago about Kamala Harris. He doesn't seem to be totally sure how to attack her. So I do think it's been an incredible month for the Democratic Party, but I do think reality will set in, especially as we start seeing Kamala Harris hopefully give more media interviews. She has not given any interviews since becoming Democratic frontrunner here.
Plus, Greg Pratt.
Well, one of the interesting comments that former Republican challenger to Trump, Nikki Haley, made was that the first party to drop their near octogenarian from the ticket was going to be the party that wins. And I think that that is an energy that you sort of see. Obviously, the election isn't over. There's a lot that can happen. But I think it's a really astute comment about where the dynamics are, where the country was unsatisfied with these two people. Now they've got something new to look at.
Yeah, Shia?
Well, and you look at the age was such a big issue when it was Biden versus Trump. And suddenly you look at Trump and Harris and you think, oh, wow, he's the older guy. Like, you didn't really notice it before. And suddenly age is taken a different shift, I think. And that goes to what Nikki Haley said. I think and to what Laura said, too, you know, Democrats were just excited to root for somebody, and they finally have somebody new to root for.
Yeah, but Alex, when those of us who were in Milwaukee saw a kind of excitement, and admittedly, the Republican convention happened right after the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, but the excitement level there was high, almost a fervor level. Do we discount that?
I think that they are probably feeling very different now than they did back then. Like you said, it was a completely different world. It was an 180-degree sort of difference. They were feeling this air of inevitability, like Trump was going to be president and they just needed to know by how much. And there was this sense of dread on the other side of it, of there were these, you know, festering questions of, is President Biden actually going to be able to stay in the race? And I remember actually there were advocates for him dropping out at the time. One I keep thinking about of James Carville, the great, you know, Democratic strategist, commentator, saying like, we're going to be sitting Shiva in Chicago for 4 days. It's going to be brutal. It's going to be a dirge, which of course is a reason why Republicans were so, you know, excited in the first place. But now it really seems like there is so much energy on the Democratic side. And if anything, you know, it makes me a little concerned that there will not be very much incentive for the Harris campaign to give interviews or to come out with policy, because they're seeing this, if you want to call it that, momentum, their polling position get better. It's sort of like, why should we change anything? Why should we get in the way of that?
Oh, I think they're going to have to do policy. They're going to have
eventually,
to do interviews,
yeah.
First of all, because the Trump campaign is going to really hit them hard and keep hitting them till they do it. Secondly, if you know, this is not going to be about the base. You want the base to be energized. Harris wants her people to get out, but you're going to have to worry about those swing voters. And they want to see some substance. They want to see some issues. They're uncertain, and they're just, it's not just about Biden being too old. It's about them being uncertain about whether this is the candidate, this is the party that they want to go with. So they're going to have to lay it out and put some really strong policies on the table. The thing that fascinated me about that whole dynamic when it changed over was that the Trump campaign was so unprepared for it. Now, you know, we didn't know what Biden was going to do, but the pressure had been building all the way up to the day he dropped out. And it became clearer and clearer that he wasn't going to be able to stay in. And in the meantime, I think the Trump people, including Donald Trump, who to this day is still saying, well, what about Biden? Whatever happened to Biden? He can't get over the fact that Biden's not in the race. So they were completely unprepared. They had no strategy. They had no talking points. They weren't able to pivot. And as it was said earlier, they still haven't pivoted. They're still scrambling around trying to find issues and talking points and strategies that are going to work against Kamala Harris.
And understand how to compete against a woman, black candidate. I think he hasn't figured out how to talk about her, how to talk to her. That debate in September is going to be really interesting.
Are you suggesting that it's a bad idea for Trump to campaign on a platform of the black lady is not a black lady?
Yeah.
It's not working for him so far.
I do think, you know, this is still truly a toss-up race, and I think there is all this excitement, especially in liberal circles, especially from all the media coverage, but Trump could very well still be elected. So I think, you know, we'll see after, maybe the things will die down after the convention next week, although maybe they won't. Maybe the Kamala wave will continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think underestimating Donald Trump is how he got into office in 2016. There are still people who are, in their minds, afraid of what would happen if Democratic rule continued in Washington. You could feel that in Milwaukee with the Republicans. They had a palpable fear that their lifestyle would not be what they want it to be.
You could say the same for the other side as well.
Right. I mean,
Biden's big point was we could see the end of democracy if Trump is reelected. But the other interesting dynamic is that it seems like it's sort of flipped in terms of where the fear factor is. You know, Trump was the scary guy who was going to end democracy, who was a criminal, all this kind of stuff. Now, up against Kamala Harris, you're seeing more of a weaker Trump. He's not looking as big and scary as he did when he was up against Joe Biden. And I think that partly that's because Kamala Harris has so much momentum and because she's changed her messaging. She's not talking about the end of democracy, the world's going to end. She's talking about this guy's weird, this campaign is
weird.
It's
a little bit more nuanced, right, to make it relatable to regular people who don't understand what doom and gloom. Does it really matter who the president is? But if you're talking about weird, you know, that's a word we sort of get.
Well, both political parties have things that they can talk about that affect normal people and they speak to people's concerns about it. And one of the interesting things about Trump that has been really would concern me if I was his strategist is they gave him a 3,000-word speech for the RNC. He delivered a 12,000-word speech. He should be running the Joe Biden 2020 campaign of say a few things, speak to some issues, don't do anything crazy and stay in your basement. And he'd be in better off than coming out and reminding people about some of the chaos and uncertainty, like the comments about Kamala Harris, which don't really do anything for anyone. I don't know who that is, who he's speaking to, other than his own id.
Well, his visit to Chicago is a perfect example of that, too. He must have known he would get questions about how he has spoken and treated black people. So he should have been prepared. I thought the question did come out really strong initially.
And you're talking about the NABJ?
Yeah, the NABJ conference. And he could have finessed it a little bit at the beginning. Instead, he dug right back in.
And I'm going to want to move on to something else, but I sincerely believe he gave exactly the answer that he wanted to give. I think he wanted to push back hard, at least on that, and not answer the question that he was asked. Which
he was speaking to his base.
Yes.
He wasn't speaking to the black journalists in the room.
Right.
That's true.
But let's start talking about some of the issues in the race, because if there was any complaint, I think that I personally had after the debate between the former president and the current president, it was that if you had only seen the news coverage of that event, you would have no idea what either man had said about any issue, because the only coverage was Biden not being able to handle things. You wouldn't even know what Trump said about any issue. So let's start talking about some of the issues, and the big one for Republicans and Democrats in different directions: immigration. I mean, Donald Trump and Republicans attack Kamala Harris as the designated border czar, and the GOP attacks running mate Tim Walz for last year signing legislation that open state services and benefits to undocumented immigrants. And they call those examples of the Harris-Walz campaign radical left. Is that a good path for them?
I think on the base level, yes. I think it's important to note that Kamala Harris was never an official border czar. She wasn't charged with looking at the root causes of migration in South and Central American countries, but it could be an effective talking point. I do think President Biden's decision to strictly limit asylum seeking in June, I can't believe it was only 2 months ago, did have a big impact. In Chicago, we haven't seen a bus of migrants arrive here in, I believe, almost 2 months.
Right.
So I do think that kind of shifted the narrative, whereas before, Trump was making pretty easy comments about open borders and how they're just coming to cities, et cetera. But I do think that will remain an effective tactic for Trump. Whether Harris can counter that, it kind of remains to be seen. We haven't seen any specifics on what she would do immigration-wise in her policy platform.
There, Democrats seem to be saying, look, we had a bipartisan deal, and Trump waded into it and scared Republicans off of it, so the deal never happened, and that immigration could have been solved a little bit earlier before Biden got involved, but Trump got involved. So that'll be the talking point, I think, of Democrats.
Yeah. Alex?
What's interesting is that it seems like Democrats have really seized upon that, and if anything, Kamala Harris, one of her first, if not only, issue-based ads that has come out has been on that specific topic and saying Kamala Harris is going to secure our border. And it's interesting, it's a reflection of your seeing just this very different sort of political climate than existed even 4 years ago, where it seems like the country, and even by extension sort of the center of the Democratic Party, is more immigration skeptical, immigration hostile, whatever you want to call it. But it seems like the more mainstream sort of take that the Harris campaign is running toward is one of, you know, strong borders and limiting immigration, and they're really trying to own that topic, including with that the fallout from that failed bill and now with this ad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are still seeing, at least in big cities like Chicago, immigrants on the streets. If you're in the downtown area, you'll see every street corner as somebody selling candy. And there is that fear, at least in some of the disinvested neighborhoods, that somehow the resources that might have gone to those neighborhoods are now going to migrants. And so that's, I think that that's a vulnerability for the Democrats.
Well, one of the few, you know, when Trump came to NABJ, he had one specific strategy in mind, which is pit black people against migrants. You know, he was a talking point he kept turning back to, which is a real dynamic that you see in the city of Chicago and in other places where you have people who have been here for a while and disinvested areas and poor areas who have some resentments about some of this. And he's been trying to stoke that, except it's pretty transparent, you know, and so it hasn't necessarily been received as well. But that's something that he's stoking, and Harris is trying to counter it by saying he blew up the deal that would fix this problem, but we're closing down the border anyway. And she's a border state senator. She was a border state senator in California. She is much better equipped to talk about that than Joe Biden was.
I think that stoking those fears, though, is not just African-American versus Latino or the immigrants from South and Latin America and African-Americans. It's also immigrant families or immigrant, historically immigrant families who here in Chicago who have resentments about, you know, we're not that much better off than the migrants that they're accepting. So I think that tension was there long before these Greg Abbott and company started sending these folks here. But I think that in terms of policy, I think long term, she's also going to have to be able to address not only closing the border, but what do we do with the folks that are already here who aren't here legally, who technically can't get work, who are sitting on the street selling candy. We're going to have to find a way to adjust the policy and laws to address that. Because I think there's a really compelling argument to make, and maybe this should be part of our argument, that these people are valuable to us. We need good workers. We need people who can work in the restaurants, work in the stores, and fill these jobs and contribute to the tax base. But in order to do that, we have to get them legalized and get them into the system.
And at the Republican convention, you had Donald Trump, what the placards were saying, mass deportation. I mean, that there are stories out about how mass deportation, deporting people, would cause inflation in a whole different way. It would hurt the economy in a whole different way.
Yeah, and that's never a winner because it's such a everybody knows somebody who immigrated here, who they like, who they respect, who they appreciate. And so even people that have issues with the border, concerns about this, don't like the sound of mass deportation. We're going to get rid of millions and millions of people because it sounds ominous.
What are you going to do, knock on doors? I mean, it sounds terrible.
But certain Trump surrogates have talked explicitly about doing that very thing. Whether logistically that could even be possible is another question.
Yeah.
But I do think that kind of the larger, you know, there's been so much media coverage on the migrant crisis, the so-called migrant crisis. We haven't talked a lot about the Dreamers, people who have been here and seeking a life here for, their whole lives, potentially, if they came here with their parents. You know, I think Donald Trump has not made any promises about protections for that population, whereas Democrats, in theory, have. So it will be interesting to see if any of that plays out in this election, especially as more and more Latino people seem to be kind of voting for Trump or supporting him.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. This weekend, you're hearing a portion of the political analysis we performed on the presidential race with Laura Washington at the Chicago Tribune and ABC 7 Chicago, Gregory Pratt with the Tribune, Alex Nitkin with the Better Government Association's Illinois Answers Project, Quinn Myers with Block Club Chicago, and Shia Kapos with Politico. Back to our discussion.
Let's turn to another headline issue that people care about. Crime. The Trump campaign accuses former California Attorney General Kamala Harris of releasing dangerous criminals back onto the streets and being in favor of sanctuary cities and defunding the police. But Trump himself has courted the African American vote by promoting second chance efforts for those who have been incarcerated. Again, the messages seem to be coming from different directions, but is anybody delivering a coherent message except that one side wants to protect ownership of guns and the other side wants to severely limit it?
Well, I don't think it's quite that stark, though, because of Tim Walz, the vice presidential nominee to be, or already nominee, is, you know, he's a hunter, he's a gun owner, he's very prominent and proud of that. He's proud of the fact that he once had his NRA rating has changed over time because of that. And I think that helps that helps leaven the Democrats and Harris's position on guns. The argument I think they're going to make is that, you know, we want to ensure safety. We want to ensure that people are safe from illegal use of guns. We want to make sure the guns are kept out of the hands of the wrong people. And that, I think, is a compelling argument that they can make.
But there's really been no talk about, you know, curbing crime. And, you know, in the past few years, we've seen several waves of tough on crime and then kind of backing off of it. I don't think I've seen any policies that really look at, you know, cities like Chicago, big cities that are dealing with crime waves, robberies, et cetera. There's been loose talk on broad talk on gun control, but how that will actually trickle down to a city like Chicago is still pretty unclear.
Plus, crime is dropping in Chicago, which makes it a more difficult talking point, I think.
Crime, like the economy, is a highly personal thing for people, and they don't, you know, how they feel about it doesn't necessarily track with statistics. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. In fact, those two issues are very much alike. People don't feel safe, and you tell them crime is dropping, but they hear the headlines. You know, how many young people in Chicago were shot and killed over the weekend? This weekend,
there's a body count every weekend,
yeah.
And that's, yeah, that dominates the headlines, and that's, yes, all people see and hear.
But when you have a police superintendent saying, well, no one actually died on the weekend, but one person succumbed to their wounds, and you know, you're still, how many people were shot? We are not hearing the solid policies, I think. And what can they say? I mean, the gun issue seems to be where some of this has to go, but it seems like both sides are afraid to really grapple with it.
Well, you know, on crime and on guns, but specifically on crimes, they're interlinked. You know, young people really care about school shootings. They care about gun violence because they've lived an entire existence of every few months, some whack job gets a big gun and shoots a whole bunch of people for no reason, and the government doesn't do anything about it, and they get upset. And young people really feel that acutely in a way that other generations don't. And that's going to be a recurring issue that's a problem for Republicans and something that Kamala Harris will probably be talking about in terms of certain types of weapons being an issue. But in general, they're not talking a ton about crime. And it's interesting. They're trying to go after walls over the George Floyd protests. But, you know, we've seen locally and we've seen nationally that the defund the police argument doesn't kill candidates the way that they thought it would. You know, they made that argument against Brandon Johnson in Chicago, and he was able to win. They made that argument. They're making that argument against Tim Walz and Kamala Harris. And so I think people aren't looking for slogans. They're looking for something more substantive.
Partially because none of these people ever actually have defunded police departments.
Yeah.
Even if it was a slogan, like, this mayor in Chicago has increased the police, you know, budget and probably will again. And so did, you know, Harris in whatever capacity and Walz.
Yeah, I mean, it seems as if people didn't really mean defund the police. What people meant was take some of the money that is maybe being spent on police and putting it in mental health. And when you frame the argument that way, I think you get more acceptance from people. Quinn?
I was just going to say, we have seen some backlash against, you know, the DAs and the top prosecutors around the country. You know, the recent state's attorney's election here was in some ways a referendum on crime here. It'll be interesting to see if that, you know, trickles upwards. Although I do think, you know, the two candidates in the Democratic primary were actually not too dissimilar. They had to draw some lines there to appeal the voters.
For
Cook County State's attorney. But you would, you know, the candidate who was very simply labeled the tough on crime candidate did win that election.
Well, the only thing I would point out to that, because you're right, but even the so-called tough on crime DA candidate in county state's attorney candidate, in her TV ad, she was talking about restorative justice, which is how far the pendulum has swung, where even the tough candidate is talking about not tough stuff.
Well, you're hearing about half of what we did and said in the studio, but let's jump ahead a bit where the discussion turned to reproductive rights. That was a big issue the last time. It's still an issue. I'm not sure it's the same this time? What
are the voters, those Republican, probably women voters, who might not be sure what to think about Trump, who support abortion rights, who support reproductive rights, to hear him make comments about gender the way he does that, I could see that turning those voters off. And those are the people that he wants to keep in the Republican Party. So I think it is a mistake on his part to start using the gender card, you know, because I think there are Republican women on the bubble who he could bring into the fold.
But is it smart or should Democrats make an assumption that the reproductive rights issue is all theirs, and that is, I mean, because I've seen, if not more, but I've seen a substantial number of people who are anti-abortion on the Democratic side too.
Yeah, but I think reproductive rights has been a winning issue for the Democrats in the last couple of election cycles. For one thing, it really energizes their base and gets people out. They want to make sure that those rights are protected. And for another thing, they've been much more expansive in terms of how they look at abortion rights. And now we have these laws that are these referenda, these policies that are popping up in states. We just saw it in Arizona where they're going to put something on the ballot that, if it's passed in November, would protect those rights. Those are the kinds of agenda items, those are the kinds of laws and efforts that will really bring out voters, women voters, whether they be Democrats or Republicans.
This is an issue, sorry, Greg, that was a winner for Democrats in states like Kansas and Kentucky. And so I think that, just like Laura said, Democrats very rightly realize that at this moment in this political climate, it makes policy and politics sense for them to lean in on it. And I think we're going to hear a lot about it next week.
And she'll be talking about that. You know, it's implicit in her message of we will not go back, which is part of the argument that she's trying to make. And, you know, on those levels, I'm surprised that the Harris campaign and Democrats aren't making a bigger deal out of the Supreme Court as it relates to gay marriage rights and to LGBTQ rights, which the Supreme Court has been clear they're going after. You know, Thomas and Alito have been pretty clear about we have an issue with these past rulings, and young people in particular are very against that. You know, they're very against going after that. So I think a lot of these social issues are winners for the Democrats if they go after them, and some of them they're not quite talking about, but they probably should.
You're seeing Walls talk a lot about it, you know, using kind of, you know, down home language, like get them out of our, you know, they
should
be
own damn
mind
business.
Mind your own damn business. So that goes to those issues, I think.
My thanks to my colleagues and friends, Shia Kapos, Quinn Myers, Alex Nitkin, Greg Pratt, and Laura Washington, for a great afternoon of talk and analysis. The Democratic National Convention is this week here in Chicago. Lots to look and listen for. Now, to our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website. That's WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Dellamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Postseason baseball is here, and it is the absolute best time of the year. I'm Rob Bradford of Baseballs and Boring, and we're going to have you covered every step of the way with instant reactions from players and coaches and managers and fans and reporters and everybody else who is immersed in this awesomeness and all the craziness that comes with October baseball. So follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.